This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now download as a podcast off our website, progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about class in America, and with me to discuss this is Betsy Leander Wright, author of Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists. Betsy Leander Wright, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Matt.
You've been doing organizing for almost 20 years now. Why don't you give us a sense of your background and how you got to do the work that you're doing?
Okay, it's actually almost 30 years now. I hate to admit it, but it's been a long time. Well, I grew up in a middle-class homeowning family with college-educated parents, and I had a path to activism that's really common among people from my class background, which is going to college, having all that flexible time, sitting around arguing politics with the other students on the grass and reading radical books and having light bulbs go off over my head. Everything I had been taught about U.S. society, I discovered was wrong. And so I dropped out of college and became an anti-nuclear power activist, which was a big growing movement in the late 70s.
Why did you drop out of college?
I thought that I would learn more by immersion in activism than I was learning at college, and I actually think I was right. I was at Princeton University, which is a little bubble away from the rest of the world, and with very good radical professors who taught me a lot, but I felt ready to learn from experienced activists instead of from academics.
And what were some of those things you started to learn right away?
Well, I was in an organization called Movement for a New Society, which was a national network of activists. And when I arrived in MNS, there was a whole influx of people like me, young, college-educated people, and they were having a revolt by the working class people in the organization. A lot of the founders were longtime anti-Vietnam War and civil rights activists from working class backgrounds. And they were really fed up with the people like me. They thought we were pretty flighty and oblivious and, not really fired in the same furnaces that had made them such tough activists. And they were doing working class speak outs. And pointing out the ways that our behavior was really obnoxious. For example, with sliding scales of who pays how much when we would have a retreat or something, there'd be a sliding scale. It goes down to zero all the way up to paying a lot. What they discovered is that all of us who were working part-time and, living on practically nothing, we'd show up, we'd have $10 in our pocket, we'd put in $10. And there were people from working class backgrounds that were working extra hours and saving all year to save up the money to pay the average. So that was a typical pattern that reflected our class differences. So this was like an enormous eye-opener for me.
It reminds me of an anecdote in your book where a group of middle class or upper middle class activists said they wanted to go on a hunger strike somewhere, and I can't remember the details. And one woman who wasn't from that class said, I can't participate in that. And the person was probed, and it turns out, she was living on crackers or cheese and crackers or peanut butter crackers. And to go without food was something that she wasn't capable or wanted to do given her situation.
Right. So there's a lot of obliviousness among middle-class activists of why things look really different. The route to activism is often very different, much less individualistic usually for working class and poor people. There's often some kind of we involved, such as we the people who work at this workplace, or we the people in this neighborhood, we the people who are affected by this problem. And that's really foreign to people who are, taking individual stands of conscience. And there's often that culture clash and that not understanding the real risks involved. So several times in the interviews, I interviewed 40 people for the book, and several times the issue of civil disobedience came up as a class difference. Now, of course, in the world, the people who have pioneered civil disobedience are low-income people of color. So it's not that this is universal for all time, but in the last 20 years in the U.S., there's been a real, it's become a real common cultural thing among the, from the time that I was an anti-nuclear activist, the young college-educated white activists, to the globalization activists now, who also tend to be young white college-educated people, that risking arrest is just commonplace. It happens all the time. And to say, wait, for groups that have undocumented immigrants in them, very risky. For people who've got, you know, men of color who could get beaten in jail, much more risky. And over again, grassroots groups finding that the young white activists are oblivious to why that would be a class thing to always insist on civil disobedience.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm speaking with my guest, Betsy Leander Wright, who's the author of Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists. Part of that obliviousness comes from a sense of entitlement, I suppose, mm-hmm. and unconscious entitlement at that. And how hard is that for activists to get beyond, and how do they get beyond it?
Well, it's an endless process. I think a lot of us who've had our consciousness raised to some degree, we still need it. Our consciousness raised a lot more. I think getting that feedback that that it's not really working, to if you're in a cross-class coalition, the behavior that was good behavior as a middle-class person growing up, so speaking up in school, being confident with your ideas, that was the behavior that was rewarded, being competitive with other people, criticizing things and trying to be right in your criticisms. It's not that we're all jerks. Some of us are jerks, but most of the middle-class activists that are perceived as entitled and arrogant are not people with terminal personality flaws, but are doing the things that we've been conditioned to do. And so you need kind of to recondition yourself and say, wait a second, the behavior that was rewarded my whole life, it's not working here. I got to do more listening. I got to talk in a more humble way. I got to look for ways to merge ideas that you, to put together the gifts that other people, especially working class and poor people, are bringing to the table with my gifts, and find ways that we can combine our strengths.
Is there almost a unclearable obstacle of, what should I say, maybe condescension for the white middle class or white upper class activist to come down, even using the word come down, and go help an organization, a working class organization, or a poor people's organization, or a welfare rights organization? I would see that that's kind of a problem, and yet you stress the importance of cross-class working and organizing.
Right. If you think you're the savior or you're the missionary, that's going to be an obstacle. And I think some of the strongest allies, whether it's white people against racism or middle-class people of any race sticking up for poor people, some of the strongest allies I've ever known were people who got it, how their own self-interest was tied up in it too, that this is going to be better for all of us. And I frame the in the book, I say, well, why should we go? What's the motivation? Why should we go for cross-class alliances? And I'm talking to people who passionately want social change in some way. Say that you're an environmentalist. You passionately want us to treat the earth better, want these environmental catastrophes not to happen. So one reason to build cross-class alliances is because you're going to meet your goals better. Because you're going to have, like, there's some environmental groups that have built bridges to the environmental justice, environmental racism groups, grassroots groups, mostly of people of color, who are in danger of being poisoned by the facilities that are sited in their communities. Some environmentalists have built strong bonds and with environmental justice groups where they've worked together for their joint goals. Other environmental groups have said, that's not our agenda. You know, we're single issue, saving the whales or whatever. And they are weakening their own cause.
Betsy Leander Wright, you were talking about environmental racism, environmental disasters, which obviously brings to my mind anyway the disaster of Katrina. To me, the coverage was amazing. Bush's statements were even more amazing. Oh, my God, there's poverty. Or, oh, my God, there's racism. A confession he had to make because his poll numbers were going down so far. What was your reaction to Katrina?
Well, of course, I was shocked that people were shocked that there's poor people and that so many of the poor people are black. I feel like, do people read? How could you not know that? But it is true that class and especially very poor African Americans have been off the national radar screen for a while. And I think we're going to see something very interesting coming up. I think in the aftermath of the disaster, there were many, many media images of poor people in the form that America likes poor people, which is destitute, needy, grateful, poor for no thought of their own, no fault of their own. And
looting, too.
Right. And that's the other thing, that some of them are criminals. Those are the stereotyped images. And in Massachusetts, our governor, Mitt Romney, said, would he house some of our own homeless people the way he's generously housing some of the Katrina homeless people? And he said, no, that's different. This is a natural disaster. I don't want to create a permanent state of dependency. So if you're homeless because there are no homes that are rentable for the income that you earn, then you're not one of the deserving poor. The other thing will be the power struggle over who gets to rebuild and how. This could be a historic moment where people who've been disenfranchised for decades and centuries could have a voice in making their city work for them. And there's already groups that are saying, we want some of that federal money to flow to community-controlled groups. The group ACORN, a national group, is headquartered in New Orleans. Their headquarters were wiped out. They want to be part of the rebuilding of the city. Youth Build USA has a youth build there where young people, young high school dropouts, build things, learn construction skills while getting their GEDs, and build things that are needed by their community. So youth build workers could do some of the rebuilding. Or is it going to be Halliburton? And are all these poor people who are seen as a problem to their own city going to be shipped out to these manufactured houses that are being laid out in rows by the hundreds out in the outskirts where they do not necessarily want to live?
It has been amazing to watch, hasn't it? And I'm struck by your anecdote from Boston, because here in Madison, Wisconsin, we were taking a few families also, and actually they were being placed in a very poor neighborhood here in Madison, and some of the poor residents of that neighborhood said, look it, we need help here too. And a lot of people here probably don't even know that neighborhood, or certainly know the people very well in that neighborhood. This seems to me an opportunity to address the poverty that's right in our midst. It reminds me of my days in the anti-apartheid movement, and I was in the Boston area. And a lot of activists in the community were saying, look, you know, it's great that you're wanting to fight racism in South Africa. We got racism here in Boston that we need to work on, too. It's not an either or. But isn't there that possibility now for activists who want to help fight poverty and help the victims of Katrina to really look in their own communities?
Absolutely. There is. And to use that criterion that I was saying of when you give money or you give time, are you giving it to groups that leave the poor people in the role of charity recipient, which, of course, in the immediate aftermath of a disaster, there's not too many other choices. So I don't have a problem with the Red Cross being the first one in. But are you giving your money and your time to groups that do that? Or are you giving your money and your time to groups where the personally affected people, the historically poor people, are in charge?
And how do you find groups, or how would a listener find which groups those are other than ACORN, for instance?
Well, I know that the Kensington Welfare Rights Union in Philadelphia has repeatedly organized summits of groups led by poor people, and I think they have a newsletter and a website. It does take some doing, to hear the voices of working class and poor people for any of us, no matter what our background, takes some real doing, because if you open the newspaper and read it, you're seeing the words of college-educated people. If you turn on the TV, you're hearing the voices of college-educated people, almost all the books in the library. So you actually have to proactively do something. You have to get on the Jobs with Justice list so that they send you these alerts when working people in your area need solidarity stands, or you need to find those anti-poverty groups that are run by poor people and go to their meetings and listen. It takes proactive effort to get a balance of voices coming into your life.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today, Betsy Leander Wright, author of Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists. She also heads up communications for United for a Fair Economy. Betsy, do you want to give a website or two for people who want to look at your book or look at your organization?
Yeah. My own website is www.classmatters.org. I always have an interactive survey question there where you can write your answer to a question, and then I post some of the responses on the website. Currently, the question is, are there class cultures? And I'll also mention the website of United for a Fair Economy, which is faireconomy.org. And UFE is a group that looks at growing economic inequality, the gap that's widening between the super rich and the rest of us.
You talk about class cultures in your book and also just class identities. You mentioned that one sociologist said there were 60 different classes. That would be a big book. And you reduce them to four. Do you want to talk about what those four classes are and how you define them, and then maybe what some cultural differences are that you've seen?
Yeah, and I want to preface that by saying that I don't think there's any absolute truth to how you divide up the class spectrum. There's, you know, we have a wide spectrum experience based on our education, our income, and our occupation. And you can slice that spectrum up in any number of ways. But what I'm looking for is the points at which there are difficulties in coalitions, when groups come together. What are the class differences where there's different ways of talking, different ways of defining the goals, different ways of doing group process? And I do the patterns that I saw fit into one of these four categories. So I'll say owning class is people who have enough income from investments in their family that they don't have to work to live. I think that's a formative experience, especially if you have it growing up, that even if you do work, it makes you see the world differently. It makes you behave differently in coalitions. And that's different than other class privileged people who are professional middle class, which is the class I described myself as coming from, which is, you know, if you have college educated parents and you're expected to go to college, you're in a profession where you have a lot of control of your time and your tasks, and you get a salary or professional fees, not wages, and you're a homeowner. That's the professional middle class. We are working people, but we have so many advantages compared to what I call working class people and lower middle class people. I make this very broad category of about half of the U.S. population as people who have to work for a living for wages or from a very small business that's hands-on, and have a pretty steady work and steady housing, whether it's homeownership or rental, which I contrast with living in chronic poverty. It's a subset of working class people who don't have steady, adequately paying work, don't have steady, secure housing, but have the chaos that comes from not having basic needs met. So that's my four ways of dividing up the spectrum.
And it's interesting because your book notes that that it's an illusion that most people consider themselves middle class. I've heard that must be 100 times. Why is that false?
Well, when people are asked in polls, are you middle class, upper class, or lower class? 90% of Americans polled say middle class. But that's because upper class and lower class do not really have a positive ring to them. When working class is one of the choices, then almost half of everyone defines themselves as working class. So I think the idea that there's no awareness of class differences in this country, I think is false. I think it's not talked about openly, and it's not always talked about in those terms. But we have all kinds of working class cultures in this society that have their own slang for when somebody's being snotty or somebody's got, you know, more privileges than are good for them. That have ways of signaling solidarity among working people.
What are some of the cultural differences that you see among these groups? I mean, there are cultural differences within, including race, which we should talk about too, but leaving that aside for the moment, what are some of the cultural characteristics of these groups?
Well, I'll say some that I think come up in coalition meetings. There's many cultural differences, but let's say group process. There's a out of professional middle class culture has grown a whole set of ways of doing group process. Consensus decision making is one. Starting everything by going around the room and everybody answering the same question is one. And putting a lot of time and attention on group process. That I would contrast that with working class culture that came out of unions, although it's not, and out of more strict religions, but it goes into grassroots groups formed by working class people too, which is more formality in the roles and the ways of making decisions, and much more quick to get to the, down to the business. You know, like they, you hear these complaints from neighborhood groups or from union people. I hate going to those meetings with those peace activists or whatever because they could talk about the group all day. It drives them crazy. And then that contrasts with a very, very informal style in grassroots groups led by very poor people, where the idea of doing it formally is foreign, and also the idea of sitting around, you know, going around doing go-rounds and so forth is also foreign.
And actually, you make some comparisons between the styles in alliances between the very highest group, the owning class,
yeah,
and the lowest group.
I know. That's probably the most controversial thing I said in the whole book, because it is my what I've observed is that there's a pragmatism. The classes that where steady work is expected to be your whole life, there's a pragmatism and playing the negative role of, no, we can't do that because it costs too much, it takes too much time, we've tried that before and it's failed, pulling things back down to earth. The people who I have observed thinking outside the box and making the suggestions that seem wacky, that sometimes are brilliant and visionary, and sometimes, in fact, are wacky and flaky, are often the people who have a life experience that's outside the labor force. So either owning class people who don't have to work, who can sort of float around and volunteer their time, or people who've been in chronic poverty for years and haven't been in the labor force. And obviously what happens to their ideas is very, very different, because owning class people can self-fund their ideas. People tend to listen to them because they're probably donors. Whereas, so rich people's bad ideas don't fail, and poor people's good ideas don't go anywhere because no one listens to them or funds them. So I'm not saying what happens to the ideas is the same, but the freedom of being outside the box, I do see a parallel.
Betsy Leander, I talk for a second, if you would, about the divisiveness of prejudice, of race, and that cuts both ways. There's so you talk about that in your book, and what are some of the conclusions that you've come to on that?
About race prejudice in particular?
Yeah, in the way that you work with, for instance, you were working with a white activist who was just starting along, but it confessed to you his feelings that I don't like black people don't like me.
That's right.
How'd you address that situation?
Oh, it was a very upsetting situation. I wrote this in a part of the book where I'm talking about the stereotype that white working class men are more racist than other white people and more sexist than other men, which I think is a false stereotype. Sometimes there is an additional outspokenness. So this guy says to me in a car, a white guy who worked in a garage, said that just what you said, I don't like black people and black people don't like me. And I took a deep gulp and I did not jump down his throat, which I've done many times, but I said, why would you say that? What's going on? And he told me these stories of growing up in a poor neighborhood that was majority black, being in a white gang that fought with the black gangs. And that was his life experience. And I listened to his stories and listened to his stories and told him that my stories were different. Told him about having colleagues of color and black friends. And then I brooded about it. I thought, I have to do something about this. This guy is a great activist, but he's got these horrible racist beliefs. So I was setting up a canvas, a door knocking thing where we were going to go around the neighborhood and get petition signatures. So I paired him up with this very, very gentle, soft-spoken black gay man and sent him off to a neighborhood of mostly elderly homeowners, black homeowners, and had him knock on doors there all day. And at the end of the day, I asked him, so how'd it go? And he just said, oh, I'm a sucker for old people. But I never heard him say anything against black people again. And then this thing happened that just still blows me away. I moved away from that town. I came back 6 months later, and I looked him up and went out for lunch with him or something. And he said, Betsy, the second he saw me, he said, Betsy, I've got a story to tell you. He worked in a garage. He said, there was this guy at the garage, a white guy, that was always saying nasty stuff about black people. So one time I had to send two guys on a long tow job. So I paired him up with this really nice black guy, and I sent the two of them away where they had to drive together for hours. And then when he came back, he didn't say that nasty stuff anymore. So I felt like I just love that story, that he took the lesson that I gave him of having a different experience that would dissolve his prejudices, and he gave that gift to someone else.
It is an amazing organizer's success story.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about a different kind of stereotyping, and that's the stereotyping of the white working class that members of the white middle and upper class impose on them.
That's right.
And there was a cartoon that just shocked me in your book. It shocked me because the date was 1999, and I thought people were more sensible than this. This was a cartoon with a depiction of a redneck, and the redneck is in the headline. This is an overweight, fat white guy with his trousers halfway down his butt.
Mm-hmm.
And what does the cartoon say?
It was about a fight over raising property taxes to pay for better schools in Winchester, Massachusetts. It said, "Don't let the rednecks ruin our schools." And the guy who's this hideous stereotype, as you're saying, is the little talking bubble that comes out of the cartoon says, "Don't need no schools anyway." I just thought that encapsulated the kind of classism that, you know, there's a stereotype of white liberals of being really oblivious and in their own little privileged bubble, that we act out that stereotype far too often, and we burn bridges. Just think how you would feel if you were a working class person in that town and you were being asked to vote for higher taxes for yourself and you saw that. Would that make you feel friendly towards the people organizing for the property taxing?
That's not exactly a good tactic.
No, it was a terrible tactic. And I think this explains so much about the red state, blue state divide in our country, that there's this condescension, this expectation that all white working class people are ignorant, have bad morals. Like, think of the implications of the word, you know, trashy or low class, are right wing. And it's completely not true, but we miss the opportunity to build alliances by holding those stereotypes and by expressing them in our language.
We only have about 30 seconds left. Betsy, what is the one lesson that you'd like people to take away above all from this book, Class Matters?
I guess if you're an activist and you're trying to make a difference in your community or in the world, you have far more allies than you think you do at other class levels. And with respect and human outreach, you can build bridges and build a bigger movement than you think you can.
Betsy Leander Wright, thanks for being my guest. The book, again, is Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists. Betsy, if you could quickly give us the website.
www.classmatters.org.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.